This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasudi, born and bred in Singapore and an NUS international politics graduate. Haslinda Amin began her career in radio and has since become a prominent anchor on Bloomberg Television, interviewing the likes of Lee Kuan Yew, Prime Minister Najib Razak, as well as Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard, along with other international renowned public figures. Now, we caught up with Haslinda to find out more about this successful female journalist. Thank you for taking our call, Haslinda.
Oh, no worries. It's my pleasure.
Haslinda, you were born and bred in Singapore. I mean, how did your upbringing impact your career choices in any way?
Well, not really. Growing up, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. In fact, I think if there is one career that came to mind, it would be to be a lawyer. But, you know, every kid wanted to be a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant, all the respectable, so-called respectable jobs. But I had no intention. I had no plan to be a journalist. I'm glad I did because I love what I'm doing currently.
Okay. And what got you into radio in the first place?
Well, you know, a lot of things in my life really happened by accident. Upon graduation, I bummed around for about a year. I had friends who were sick and tired of me calling them up, asking them to, you know, go out and have a coffee or a meal with me. And one day, eventually, someone said, you know what? It's about time that you get employed. And there is an opening at this radio station. Mm-hmm. It's a new radio station called Radio Singapore International. They wanted current affairs producer presenters. So the next thing I knew, I got called to do a written test, then a voice test. Mm-hmm. And within weeks, I was called in to sign an employment a letter. That was how it started. It was all an accident. Nothing, actually, very few things in my life are planned.
What were those early days like for you in radio?
You know, it was really rough because, like I mentioned earlier, I was bumming around for about a year. And having a job meant responsibility. And being in radio, being a current affairs producer presenter, I was constantly on a deadline, even while we were being trained by a BBC trainer then. It was difficult meeting those deadlines. And I remember at one time I went home, spoke to my dad, and I said, you know, maybe this is not for me. It's too stressful. It's difficult. And he said something which sticks to me even now. He said, you know, nothing in life is going to be easy, especially when you're starting out. He said, give it a year. Decide, reassess after that 1 year. And, you know, looking back, I realized that you got to give it time to see whether it fits. And it fitted with me, fitted to a T, and really no regrets. I'm glad, you know, I went through a difficult time. Now I appreciate what it takes to be here.
Mm-hmm. And you transitioned to television after. Now, not everyone does that quite successfully. I really would like to know how you did that.
You know, frankly, I don't know. I was never trained to be in front of a camera. When Bloomberg Television first got in touch with me and said, you know, do you want to give us a shot? I said, well, not really, because I don't know what it means to be in front of the camera. I don't know what to do. I've never been trained. I was never trained in media. And, you know, my medium is radio. I was really comfortable. I liked what I was doing. I loved it. In fact, when they first offered me a position, I said no. They called me up again and said, you know, if we help to train you, would you give it a shot? And the first thing they did was to train me, and my first assignment was to report from the trading floor. Mm-hmm. I think that was quite a sink or swim moment for me. I think Bloomberg wanted to see if I was a survivor. Right. And being in the midst of traders who knew what they were talking about, who would know if I didn't know what I was talking about, it was pretty intimidating at first, but at the end of the day, if you want something, you work for it. I remember, you know, working overtime after work, reading, researching, speaking to traders, researchers, analysts to speed up my learning process, and I think that all paid off. And eventually, a medium is just a medium. It doesn't really matter if you know what you're talking about. You're confident. That's all that matters. That's what it's all about, being a journalist.
How did you build that comfort in front of the camera? Not everyone is able to do that.
You know, it really is a learning process. I remember when I first appeared on telly, my dad used to say, you roll your eyes all the time. And I wasn't aware of that because I'm not used to watching myself as well. I refrain from doing that. Mm-hmm. You learn. You do have to watch yourself. You do have to look back at all your tapes to see, did that work? Did that make sense? It was through a rigorous process of learning that I managed to do it. I'm still not trained, not formally trained in terms of TV, but I think it has worked. You just have to be yourself.
Right. You know, being comfortable in front of the camera is one thing, Aslinda, but you also need to make people want to watch you. How do you do that? Because this is something that cannot be honed.
In a way, it's true. When I said that you need to be yourself, I think when you're yourself, people are comfortable watching you because they know you're not putting an act. That's one. The other thing you have to know, you have to be prepared. If people sense, if your viewer senses that you're unsure of what you're talking about, you're ill-prepared, they'll turn you off. There's no reason why they should be spending their time watching and listening to you. Those are the two very important components to me. As for the look, I guess, you know, it all depends. People decide who they like. Not everybody likes the same face on telly.
Yeah.
People get critical. You can't please everybody. If you have enough followers, I guess that's good enough for me. It has been 10 years.
Yes, it has been 10 years. How do you keep yourself relevant and fresh? Because, as you said, people get tired of seeing the same face after a while, right? How do
I
you
think
stay
you remember
fresh?
When I first started, I had long hair. Now I have short.
So it's
change is good sometimes.
It's in the confidence and in the hairstyle.
But it is also staying relevant in terms of your coverage. I've moved along with the region. When I first started covering Southeast Asia, it was a different Southeast Asia. 10 years later, the region has matured. The region has a lot more to offer to the rest of the world. You talk about staying relevant. You have to stay relevant, not just yourself, but in terms of content.
Mm-hmm.
You try to stay fresh. And for me, I try to keep up to speed on all the relevant developments in this part of the world, whether it is politics, economics, even trends. You know, that is part of, I guess, making people interested in what you have to say.
That's on a personal level, though, Haslinda. You also have to contribute towards the station's ratings and the reputation. I mean, isn't that a lot of pressure on you?
There's always pressure. It's a pressure cooker.
Yeah, I mean, first you've got to get your content right, and then after that you've got to worry about ratings.
It is true. That's why it is important that you have credibility. I think it is through your credibility that you build a following. I'd like to think that my work portrays the kind of commitment I have in a region that I love covering. And maybe in that way, I help improve the rating. When people are interested in the region we cover, they're interested in the story you have to tell.
So it indirectly correlates anyway. So you just need to get your act together and it sort of affects station rating.
I always get my act together.
I'm sure you do. As you said, it goes back to confidence, isn't it? Am I imagining or are we seeing a flood of Asian women on money shows and lesser number of male correspondents on business television programs?
You know, personally, I think it has very little to do with gender or racial groups or nationalities. I think the way I look at it, I'm an Asian, I'm a Singaporean, I'm a Malay. It didn't matter 10 years ago, it doesn't matter today. But I think what's important is an understanding of the region that you're covering. I can be put in the U.S. if I can add value, give perspective. It doesn't matter that I came from Asia.
Right. And did you have challenges to face as an Asian working for Bloomberg Television?
Not really. I think having grown up in Singapore, I've been exposed to meritocracy. It is about professionalism. It is about what you bring to the organization. In terms of challenges, I think I face the same challenges as my colleagues from elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've faced additional challenges just because I'm Asian or maybe from a minority group.
Right. You have specialized in stories that have driven the transformation of Southeast Asia. Do tell me a bit more about some of the major developments that you have covered. I mean, you have covered anti-government clashes in Thailand and President Barack Obama's first visit to Asia. I mean, that is a huge assignment. I mean, what was that like for you?
You know, I think my journey as a journalist coincides with the journey of Southeast Asia. And having covered the politics and economics of the region for more than a decade, I have a great appreciation for where we are now today. You talk about developments that have led to the transformation of Southeast Asia. I mean, there are many, including what you mentioned as well, the anti-government protests in Thailand that happened back in 2010. They were deadly, they were bloody, there were risks involved for journalists like me. And there were journalists who were hurt. I remember reporting with a bulletproof vest on, which I borrowed from a cameraman, and that vest actually had a bullet mark on it. I mean, imagine how I felt. and the location where I reported from was burnt down beyond recognition just a day after. You know, it takes me back as well to the days leading up to Pak Suharto's downfall in Indonesia back in 1998, the hike in fuel prices, the final straw that led to the bloody street riots, shootings, total chaos. I mean, you can imagine what happened then. On one occasion, I was caught in a crossfire. On another occasion, I got fired at while trying to, you know, jump over a fence of the parliament building, trying to get to a supposedly secret meeting one night. I think both times I got pretty lucky. The reality is that it is one of the extremes of my world as a journalist, but having seen and reported on all these historic developments, I have a very good understanding of where we've been, where we're heading as a region, as a people, and that's where I hope I can add value in my coverage.
Wonderful. When we come back, we'll find out. I really want to know where we're going as a region. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasudi. On the phone with me, we're getting to know Haslinda Amin, the Bloomberg television anchor and news correspondent. And all of you would have watched her at some stage if you follow business news and things like that. You know, you said, you know, you followed Southeast Asia from, you know, from the time you started as a journalist to you think you know roughly where we're going. Where are we going, Haslinda?
We're going to big things. I mean, this is a region of 600 million people. Imagine the potential. And when you take a look at the demographics, a lot of young people, talented young people, educated, we have a lot to offer. I mean, for a very long time, Southeast Asia was sidetracked by developments in China, in India. It was pretty much overshadowed. And the time has come for the, you know, the organization of 10 nations to really get together and show the world what it has to offer. And, you know, I've studied ASEAN when I was in school. I've been covering ASEAN for a very long time now, and I'm really proud to see that it's becoming a force to be reckoned with. And that takes me to where we are today, even at Bloomberg. I mean, the fact that we have a dedicated program called ASEAN Report to look at the region, to bring the story of the region to the world, the timing couldn't be better.
Right. I watched you interview you know, Francis Yeo at the Singapore, what was it called again? The Singapore Flyer. I was watching that, you know, throughout. And, you know, you're a correspondent for First Up and High Flyers, which is a special series of interviews with Asia's business elite. You just want to tell me how that came about and why you felt there was a need for such a program.
Well, speak to someone in the U.S. or in Europe. Very few people would tell you they know what's going on in this part of the world. They know who the newsmakers are. I think there is reason for us to showcase the talent, the entrepreneurs, the newsmakers in this part of the world. I think that's basically the thinking behind ASEAN Report and High Flyers. High Flyers, you know, it traces the journey of the sharpest minds in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia, in the rest of Asia even. And you'll be surprised how inspiring some of these stories are. And why shouldn't we be sharing our experiences with the rest of the world?
Right. Did it not upset you that, or did it ever occur to you that some of these people may have been where they are because of certain backing from certain, you know, people? Does that even make a difference for you?
Well, at some stage, I guess all nations go through the same process. It's part of a rite of passage, so to speak. But nations mature and acts get cleaned up. I think it's part and parcel of, you know, the process of going from a developing world to a developed world.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we have to go through it, is what you're saying.
It's a natural process, I would like to think. When you're starting out as a nation, some things are more important than others. Mm-hmm. Ensuring that there are no racial riots, for instance, was a priority in Singapore. Different nations go through different stages, and I can only imagine that the challenges are the same for a nation going through the hardships of nation building.
Mm-hmm. And this is happening throughout Asian countries, really, at the moment.
Well, it's not just happening throughout Asian countries. I'd like to imagine it happens throughout the world. I mean, the emerging markets in the emerging countries in Eastern Europe, for instance, mm-hmm. I think would be going through the same challenges that we do in this part of the world.
Right. You must travel a great deal, Haslinda. Does it take a toll at all on your personal life at all?
I'd like to say no. I guess you draw a balance. I'm a great believer in having a balanced life, personal and work. It is challenging at times, but it can be done. I travel less now than I used to because we are growing as an organization. We have about 2,300 reporters around the world. I no longer have to be at the location in the field all of the time. We have resources that can be tapped. And we also have to draw a distinction between breaking news and news that we're chasing ourselves, which can be planned. So in that sense, you can draw a balance between your own time and work.
But I'm sure sacrifices have to be made, Haslinda.
Sacrifices have been made and will always be made. That's the nature of the job. But I guess if you love what you're doing, you don't really see it as a sacrifice. It would be something you want to do. I love what I do. I wouldn't trade what I do for anything in the world. I'm blessed that way because not many people can say that they love their jobs. I think that helps in sacrificing, if that's the word we choose to use. Right now.
You know, I'd love to know this, and this is coming from a guru like yourself to me, you know. You have interviewed a number of extremely high-profile personalities, Lee Kuan Yew being one, Julia Gillard, Prime Minister Najib Razak. I mean, how do you prepare for such big interviews?
I read, I research, and I leave no stone unturned. If truth be told, I do a lot more preparation than people would probably want to give me credit for. I think you owe it to your interviewee to know what you're talking about. Whether you read their autobiographies, if need be, you read reports on what they've said before, you follow the comments they've made, it is the professional thing to do. I would hate to think that I'm put in front of a person and I'm just wasting the person's time by asking silly questions or questions that have been answered many times before.
Okay.
I cannot underestimate the importance of preparing for an interview, especially when they're big ones. But regardless, even if they're deemed as small interviews, I think you owe it to yourself and you owe it to your guest to be prepared.
Yeah, and that leads to confidence.
Sounds like
as well.
A Girl Scout, huh?
Yeah. No, I understand exactly where you're coming from because that also leads towards you being more confident with what you're saying.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. When you actually are with these people, does it become just a job and, you know, you just go ahead with these interviews without thinking that this is the Prime Minister of Australia, for an example, in front of you? I mean, do you forget that and just get the job done?
The number one thing not to do is to be overwhelmed by your guests, because once you're overwhelmed, the mind stops working and you stop thinking as a journalist. I do get the nerves, and that's the truth, whether it's fronting, being in front of a camera, whether it's a sit-down interview with the Prime Minister, or the President, or the CEO of a company. I do get the nerves, but you have to overcome the nerves. And you can never let your nerves or your guests overwhelm you. It will stop you from performing to the best of your ability. You have to ask the tough questions. You have to ask the questions that need asking, even though, you know, sometimes before an interview, people tend to go, okay, let's not cover this area. It's a bit sensitive. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's not go there because, you know, we've talked about it to death. But the reality is, if those are the answers that your viewers want to know, then you owe it to them and yourself to do what a journalist needs to do.
Right. Do you have a strong team that supports you?
I have me. I think people misunderstand. They tend to think that your research is done by somebody else. Yeah. I do my own research, and I think it is a good thing. It's a lot of work, but it gives you the confidence. You know what you know because you've done the work. There is no shortcut to preparing for an interview. You have to put in the hours. And if it takes me days, if it takes me weeks, I will do it if it means that guarantees, almost guarantees, a good interview.
I'm just thinking, Oprah has like 6 producers, so I'm just wondering if you had a team behind you. Would you consider yourself a control freak to a very large extent? Even if you had that liberty of having a team help you, you know, you've come this far on your own. Do you think you'll ever be able to let go?
I think you have more control when you have a hand in every... I don't know. How do I put it?
You're a control freak.
Okay, let's leave it at that. I am. I guess, you know, in a huge way I am. And I like things perfect as it can be. And I only have myself to blame if something goes wrong.
Because you're the one in front of the camera, right?
Yes, and I'm the one who did the research, and I'm the one who prepped. So if I do fall short, then it is me.
Right.
Who's at fault?
Out of all the interviews you've done, Haslinda, I mean, does any one of them actually stand out among the rest or had an impact on you?
Well, an impact, I think a lot of different people leave different kinds of impact on me. But if you're talking about interviews which have stood out, a few, you know, when I interviewed John Travolta, which is out of the ordinary.
You have interviewed John Travolta. How does that jive with business?
I did. That is the highlight of the interview. You can go on YouTube. You know, it was phenomenal. Coming face to face with John Travolta, talking about his love for aviation, his love for acting, and at the end of the interview, I said, you know, you're known for your dance moves. You've got to do some for me. And he kind of like, he did a kick. I said, that's not good enough. You've got to do something more. To do a proper dance move. I said, how about something from Pulp Fiction? You know, everybody knows the move. So he said, okay, but only if you do it with me. So in front of his entourage, in front of my camera crew, we jived. And, you know, it was unbelievable. How many people in the world can say they have danced for John Travolta?
Oh, yes.
Very few, I bet.
There you go. Haslinda Amin, the girl, you know, from Singapore. You went to the Tanjung Katong Girls' School, didn't you?
I did.
But yes. A lot of people actually, I know at least, who grew up in Singapore went to a very prominent school, I have to say.
It is, and it's a very good school in the sense that it provided a really well-rounded education. I credit who I am today to the teachers and to the schools that I attended because I think they helped develop the potential in me. Mm-hmm. In a school like Tanjung Katong Girls, TKGS, and Temasek Junior College where I went to, we were exposed to different things. And we were always made to experience life, not to be afraid to try something new just because it is something new. And I think that's contributed to the adventurous spirit that I have in mm-hmm. me, the sense of independence, the curiosity. That's helped a lot in my work.
Right. A lot of us have graduated in various fields and not sort of pursued anything in that area. And you are a graduate from the National University of Singapore in international politics. Do you apply any of that or did you think it was a waste of time or, you know, did it help you in any way to do what you're doing right now?
On hindsight, it did help in the first place. I've always been interested in international politics. Even back in junior college, I did what was called Paper 7, a current affairs paper that delves into the politics of the superpowers. Then it was Russia and the U.S. So I've always been interested in it. As to how relevant, it is relevant in the sense that, you know, education like that prepares you to, opens up your mind, exposes you to different policies, what politics is all about. And, you know, you can't take politics away from economics. They're all interlinked. It's been beneficial, and it's also been helpful because the education I received helped to open and broaden my mind. It's been fantastic. But having said that, I've interviewed some lecturers and professors from school. They've always been surprised, and they always say, like, I can't say I was one of those really hardworking students. Mm-hmm. They always say, like, it's surprising how successful you've become. that says a lot about how I was in school. at the end of it, though, it's about drive. It's about what you want. And when you want something bad, I think you will work for it. And yeah. I love what I do, so that helps.
That is, you are absolutely correct. And, you know, some of us are just late bloomers. That's it. outside of work, I understand you're quite a sports enthusiast. How did that happen?
Well, I've always loved sports. You know, even when I was a kid of 6, 7 years old, I was, you know, an athlete. I was running for the school. Maybe the exposure given by my dad. Even when I was young, even as a girl, he would take me to football matches, and I know the meaning of the Kallang Roar. And he was a sportsman himself. He played tennis and was a hurdler. But for me, I guess I've always loved sports. I mean, it was an avenue for me to run around and, you know, express myself to an extent. I've played all kinds of sports, you know, handball, netball. I represented the university. I played netball competitively for a number of years. I boxed.
You boxed?
Yes, as in, whoa, like Muhammad Ali boxing. Not the Muay Thai kind of boxing.
That is interesting.
that is the most difficult sport ever. It saps every bit of energy you have, I must say. I mean, I've done so many kinds of sports all these years, but boxing really must be the most difficult. I mean, it requires total commitment, total fitness. But, you know, sports and fitness, they keep me sane. They keep me occupied. It's my distraction. People always say, oh, where do you find all this energy? And, you know, I say, I get high on air, but really it's my, I don't know, time at the gym, time playing squash, and it keeps me alive. I like how sports make me feel, and I think sports help develop another aspect of your personality. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about being adventurous earlier on, and I think that contributes to it as well.
Right. So besides sports, outside of work, how do you keep yourself busy, Jocelyn? or do you even have the time?
I always find time for the gym. That's for sure. I always find time to spend Fridays at the movies after work. I always find time for food. These are important things for me. We talk about distractions. They are my distractions, and I love doing them. And when I can, I find time to travel. Mm-hmm. I try to see and explore as much of the world as possible, because I think it is only through seeing and experiencing that you understand what's going on. When you watch something on TV, you're taking someone's word for it. Yep. When you're there in person, seeing it for yourself, there's nothing like it.
And that helps you with work as well.
That helps me with work, but more importantly, it's self-growth. You know, I travel to regions that I don't cover in my line of work, but it gives me a perspective, an understanding. It gives me something to compare with, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's an eye-opener. I'd like to see as much of the world as I can before I die.
Of course. So do all of you. So do all of us, actually. You know, Jocelyn, there's something I've always wondered about TV presenters, especially if you're a woman. You have to constantly make sure you're up to the mark in terms of your looks, which sometimes I think there's a certain amount of bias amongst the male presenters. How do you, you know, maintain yourself, you know, to keep yourself looking good?
Never thought of it that way. But
and we're all growing old.
TV does make you look 25% bigger than you actually are. So I guess
you've got to be
petite,
tiny then.
That helps. I'm not quite conscious about looks, but you know, because there's some things you need to be conscious about. Lighting, for instance. I mean, the studio in Singapore is lit a certain way. I just came back from a 5-day trip to the Maldives, and I'm like 3 shades darker because of the sun, and that does affect how I look on telly. And yes, I am aware that people get critical about how you look, and people do comment on, for instance, you know, your haircut, your lipstick color, and whether you put on weight or not. It's never quite bothered me in any way, truth be told, because maybe it helps that I'm fitness is one of my thing anyway, so I don't really worry about putting on weight or, you know, appearing bigger than I meant to. And you're right about the unfair comments that are made when it comes to women versus their male counterparts. I think it is the reality of TV, and it is a reality you have to live with if you want to stay in the business. Let's face it, TV is, in a way, a superficial medium. People judge you not just by what you have to say, but how you look. People decide way ahead of time, before you even open your mouth, they decide whether they want to listen to you, they want to watch you, they decide if they want to keep the channel on. It is the reality of it. It's unfortunate, but I guess being in the business, I've learned to come to terms with it. If that is the reality I have to live with, then it is the reality that I'm prepared to face.
What are your hopes for the future, Haslinda?
I love what I do. I hope that for me, it is about journalism. It doesn't matter the medium, whether it's radio, whether it's TV. Maybe one day I'll go to print. I'm after news. If I can stay relevant, stay in the industry, I'll be happy. I'll die happy, because I think it's been a wonderful journey for me, a very unexpected journey. I never dreamt 20 years ago when I was in school that this would be the life I would lead. I've been blessed. It's been wonderful meeting people I couldn't imagine meeting, you know, presidents, prime ministers, CEOs of the largest companies in the world. It's been such a ride for me.
Do you ever think you'd be able to let go?
I haven't thought of it. I guess you'll know when the time comes. When you stop loving what you do, when you stop wanting to go to work in the morning, I think that's the time to let it go. But as of now, not yet.
It was a pleasure speaking with you, Haslinda.
Pleasure's mine, Mira. Thank you so much.
Haslinda Amin, Bloomberg TV anchor and news correspondent on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.